What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. I'm so excited to be with you all tonight. We have a really important show. We're going to be covering really important issues. We're going to be covering issues that relate to free speech, that relate to foreign policy, issues that relate to hypocrisy, as you'll see. And we have two amazing guests we're going to be speaking to tonight. We are going to be speaking during the second half to Assad Abu Khalil about the war on Syria and what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening in Palestine. And our first guest is also extremely special and really honored to be talking to him again, bring him back onto the show. Omali Yeshitela, who is the founder of the African People Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement. And as we will be discussing shortly, he and two other members of his organization have been convicted of conspiring to act as unregistered Russian agents. So make sure you please like the show. If you haven't already subscribed, please do subscribe. If you're not already Patreon supporters, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. This Uhuru story we're doing is really important, and it's pretty pathetic, but not surprising that in a story this big isn't getting more attention from not just the left, but from the right that claims to care about the weaponization and politicization of the Justice Department and the FBI. And you'll see why I'm saying that in a couple of minutes. So welcome, Chairman Yeshitela. Hi, how are you?
I cannot hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. Good. Great. Okay. But I was going to say, we cannot afford to have you even more silenced than you already are.
So. Right.
So glad. Thank you. Yes, of course. So we're going to talk about the case against you, but I thought it would be interesting to start off to show what Joe Biden just used his power, his incredible power to do. He's still president, and there's so many things he could do that would have so much of an impact on so many lives. He could call off the war in Palestine. He could stop the proxy war in Ukraine. He could free everyone on death row. He could free nonviolent drug offenders. And let's see what he actually wound up doing.
Will you accept the jury's outcome, their verdict, no matter what it is?
Yes.
And have you ruled out a pardon for your son?
Yes. I'm extremely proud of my son, Hunter. He has overcome an addiction. He's one of the brightest, most decent men I know. And I am satisfied that I'm not going to do anything. I said I'd abide by the jury decision. I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
It's still a no. It will be a no. It is a no, and I don't have anything else to add. Will he pardon his son? No.
Is there any possibility that the president would end up pardoning his son?
No.
Major commitment from the president, accepting the outcome of the trial and also pledging not to pardon his son.
So the challenge for him is really to continue to live up to his values when it was really personal, and he did that today.
It seems like a pretty normal, straightforward answer, but it takes new weight when we see what Trump is saying about the outcome of his trial. We're hearing from other Republicans who say they don't accept the jury's verdict here in New York.
The contrast is profound. To sit there and say, well, I'm not going to intervene in the legal process and I wouldn't pardon my son. One side, Democrats and Joe Biden protecting the justice system. And on the other, Republicans and Trump protecting Trump.
A current president of the United States has
so much respect for the law that he has said he would not pardon his son.
Hunter Biden was found guilty, and Joe Biden has very clearly said he would not pardon his son, he would not commute his sentence. How stark is this difference? I mean, how can Republicans keep making this argument now that Joe Biden has really put it out there?
He is not pardoning his son, which he could do. These are federal charges. Right. He is not doing that. He is not doing it because he is living what it means to have a rule of law in this country. Yeah. And if you want to know if he believes it, you can actually see what is happening with his own son.
The contrast to how Trump has behaved, how Trump has treated the rule of law. This was a good day for the system.
So, Chairman Yeshitela, I wanted to know your response to that montage of hypocrisy.
Well, you called it. It is a hypocrisy. And I think it's extremely important that it's part, it represents a part of the crisis of the Democratic Party itself. Been severely wounded, as made manifest by this last election, the murder in Palestine that's going on, that they've and this war that they've initiated against Russia, using Ukraine as cannon fodder and also as means to which they do that. And there's nothing really different by coming from the Biden administration in this. If you remember, one of the big charges they had against Donald Trump was the fact that he did not accept the election outcome. That was the big thing. That was a real serious contradiction, they said, on the one hand. But if we remember correctly, it was the Democratic Party that refused to accept the election outcome when Trump was elected, and claimed that it was Russia, Russia, Russia. Russia is the one that's responsible for Trump's election. And for the entire time that Trump was president of the United States, they did everything they could to make it impossible for him to rule. And with the Russia claim, the same Russia claim that's charged as attacking me right now was something that was initiated by the Democratic Party against Trump, and the Democratic Party refused to accept the outcome of that election. So that was the Democratic Party. And also this clearly it reveals the fact that class makes a difference, that you come from represent the ruling class in this country, you can get away with anything except an offense against the ruling class, which is what we've been looking at, these contests that's happening between sectors of the ruling class. They're ready to jail and charge each other, impeach each other, not because of murderous wars like Ukraine or Palestine or anything like that, but because of offenses that they make against each other. So, yeah, it's really interesting. And here we have Biden, who is imprisoning me and the Uhuru 3. We've seen pictures of Hunter Biden, videos purported to be Hunter Biden, anyway, naked in a bathtub, smoking crack cocaine. We know the Burisma, the monies that came from, that even contributed to the Ukrainian war itself. The gas line, the gas company corporation that he was on, with no experience except being Joe Biden's son, and he is walking scot-free, and we haven't committed any kind of offense at all, and facing on December 16th a 5-year prison sentence and a possible $250,000 fine for each one of us. So, yeah, that's what we're looking at now. And so we're not surprised. We're not shocked. And as I mentioned, I think people should really remember that while they charged Trump with not accepting the outcome of the elections and for 4 years did everything they could to make it impossible for him to govern, it was the Democratic Party. It was Hillary Clinton. It was those forces that first claimed that they refused to accept the election outcome and said that it was the Russians who did it, the Russians, et cetera. So, yeah. Right.
And of course, I mean, they use the term election deniers as a slur, but I mean, Trump did not win the last, he won this election, but yeah. Not the one before that. Yeah. But when he won the one before that, there was a lot of, as you said, claims that it was the Russians, the Russia excuse. But also, they used election deniers as if it was inherently a bad thing to do. Now, I wouldn't say it's deniers, but, you know, when Bush was president, I wish the Democrats had actually denied that election. I wish they actually had fought back and challenged it, but they didn't, because the Democrats care so much more about norms than they do about fights.
Well, norms, to some extent. The fact is that what happened with that Bush election and Al, what's his name?
Gore.
That thing, I mean, it was clearly a violation of the civil rights, of the Voting Rights Act, that the Bush regime, those folk pushing Bush did. The Bush election campaign violated all kinds of civil rights, Voting Rights Act components to get elected. But Gore wouldn't raise it. He wouldn't say anything about the significance of that because he preferred to keep the Black question, the colonial question buried, so that this struggle would not reemerge as something that the system would have to deal with. So he suffered that loss, better a loss for himself than for the system itself to have to deal with the question of Black oppression in this country.
Right, that too, yeah. And we're going to get to your story in a second, but I want to ask you, who you think would be worthy, besides you and your fellow Uhuru members, of a pardon from Biden? Like, whose pardon should Biden be prioritizing if he were someone who actually cared about justice and fairness?
I think he would have to look like at Mumia Abu-Jamal. He would have to look at Leonard Peltier, who, you know, they've had locked up for nearly 50 years. Here's an indigenous man who, you know, they live, the indigenous people in this country right now live in concentration camps, euphemistically referred to as Indian reservations. And Peltier finds himself now in a situation where the FBI, all these federal agents are there attacking the people, and he participates in defending the people. And now he's been in prison for more than 50 years on his own land. And this is the thing that makes this so incredible, is that this system, this government, is founded on the twin pillars of stolen land and stolen Black labor. And so this issue of the freedom of indigenous people, the freedom of African people in this country, is a fundamental question. It's one that the Democratic Party participates in obscuring, undermining, et cetera. So they won't say that they're still making a war against the indigenous people. They say it's against Leonard Peltier. They won't say they're making a struggle against African people in this country. It's a struggle, an attack on the African People's Socialist Party, the Huda movement. They won't say that they're killing and keeping the Palestinian people from achieving freedom. It's Hamas, et cetera. So they would try to obscure the essence of the contradiction with these kinds of characterizations. And they think they can get away with it because they have full cooperation of the ruling class colonial media. Like this case that we are dealing with right now, they say it's a national security threat that we represent, that somehow we're working with foreign governments for Russia, this main enemy, et cetera, but they won't write a damn thing about it until they come to some conclusion, because they don't want the people to have access to any information. So the majority of people in this country right now, we're in a period where they've succeeded, the government has succeeded in hiding, obscuring, burying the struggle of African people, so that the only persons representative of Black people are the Obamas, the Kamala Harris, and what have you. But the fact of the matter is, I've been involved in this struggle for a long time, and I know that what happened in this country was that Black people had moved toward an anti-colonial politic that was represented by the Black Panther Party, the African People's Party, African People's Socialist Party, Republican New York, all these organizations, and they came under attack. It's a part of a counterinsurgency that they initiated right here in this country, and they elevated the Obamas and people like that to these positions of prestige. So the only people, the only evidence of what should represent progress for Black people are these tame forces that function within the colonial system. And let me just make this point. I think it's important because we do not engage in anti-racism politics because we think that's disingenuous. The fact is the struggle against racism is responsible for there being Black people like a Kamala Harris, that's being Black people like an Obama, Black people who function as police officers and prison guards and other kinds of custodians inside the colonial system itself. So they will make concessions against racism to put Black people in places where they can function in the colonial system to keep the rest of us oppressed.
Right. I think was it Glenn Ford or Margaret Kimberly who coined the term the Black misleadership class?
Yeah, that's what they coined it. But I really think the question is, I don't know what a Black misleadership class is. You don't know who that is until after they do something. But I do think there is a class question. I think within the struggle for national liberation, the class struggle is raging. And in fact, before they attacked us in St. Louis and St. Petersburg, Florida, the government went and met with so-called Black leaders to get their approval, to get their support for what it is that they're doing to us.
Let me just back up a little bit because I just want to set up what was done to you. And I'm going to ask you some questions. But so you are the chairman of the Uhuru Movement, which is an American, U.S.-based, right? But it's internationalist, it's Pan-Africanist. It's socialist. It was founded in 1972, and it's led by the African People's Socialist Party. And you were the chairman of that party. And tell us what was done to you, what you were charged with, and then what you were ultimately convicted of.
We were attacked, our homes and offices in seven different houses, homes and offices of our movement in two states, in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Petersburg, Florida. I was in St. Louis, Missouri when the attack happened. My wife and I, it was the pre-dawn attack that they made against us. My wife and I were up because she presides over a doula program here in St. Louis, and I was preparing to go to the gym. And so we were sitting around talking at 5 o'clock in the morning. This noise comes from this loudspeaker saying, come out with your hands up and your hands empty. And after they say this, that explosion start going off throughout the neighborhood and even in the backyard, in the back entry of our home, stairwell and what have you. And they said, this is the FBI, come out. And so we were startled. And when I went outside, I was greeted by these armed military forces with automatic weapons mounted with these laser targeting devices that were pointed at me, red dots bouncing off my chest. And then I get downstairs. I've asked my wife to call and let people know that we're under attack. She couldn't do that because they had jammed our phones. And so they zip tie me behind my back. My wife, and she gets downstairs, they handcuff her behind her back. They take our phones. They go into our houses, explosions still going off around the place. They've broken windows and things like that. They've done a similar thing on the south side of St. Louis, where the majority of the white people live, and where I am right now, where we're having this discussion. And we have a solidarity center. They broke the doors down. They use automatic battering rams. They broke windows. They stole files and electronic devices in St. Petersburg, Florida. They did the same thing to the Uhura House in St. Petersburg, Florida. They knocked down every door in the building. They went and shut down temporarily our radio station that was there. They raided our spaces and files and things like that. They took financial documents, the equivalent of this. They took something like 13 terabytes of materials. They said it's the equivalent of 2.5 billion books that they took from us at that time. And so I'm arguing with them, finding out why is it that you're doing this? And they're saying that later this morning, and this is going to be big news, this FBI guy tells me, that we're going to be, there's going to be an indictment of a Russian national who's in Russia. And your name is in the indictment. So they said, we're serving a search warrant. And I said, where's the search warrant? And you know, they couldn't show it to me because whom it didn't have it with them, the people who were dealing with us. They occupied our spaces for 6, 7, 8 hours, taking materials out of the place. And so they didn't charge us with anything. They finally said we could leave if we wanted to, and we left. And then 9 months later, they indicted us for being Russian agents, working under the direction and control of Russia and conspiring to work under the direction and control of Russia. And so in September of this year, we finally went to trial. And after the indictment, they took our passports. I have to report every week to somebody. They can come to my home when they want to. I have to get permission to travel. And some irony here, if you will, because you talk about this thing about racism, because it's an African guy, it's a black guy that I have to report to, because racism, the work that I did in the 1960s, got him a job. But his job is inside the colonial system, and he participates as an instrument of that system. So anyway, we went to trial, and they said trial was going to last for 4 weeks. It lasted 9 days. The state had no people they could to testify against us. They put a $10 million bounty on anybody who could bring information that could support their case. They got nothing. There was nobody from our movement that they talked. There were no even ex-people from the movement, people who don't like us anymore. They couldn't get anybody to come testify. They had 14 witnesses, 12 of them were FBI agents, 2 of them were so-called experts, Russian experts and what have you, and all of them had to say that they knew nothing about us doing the stuff the government said we're doing. They had to say government had charged us with somehow participating in Russian election interference because we ran 2 people for office in St. Petersburg, Florida in 2017, 2019 on reparations against gentrification. And they had to say there was no evidence of any kind of Russian interference or anything like that in the case. So it was a hard hit. And so, you know, we spent more than $500,000 on lawyers up to now. And we're still raising money for lawyers because we're going to appeal the outcome because we're going to Tampa, Florida, and we're calling on people who can't be there in Tampa, Florida, on December 16th. That's where the sentence is going to happen. If you can get to St. Petersburg, Florida, December 15th, which is right across the bridge from Tampa, Florida, having a rally that's really important because we have to show everybody that we recognize, the state needs to recognize that the people recognize that this is an attack against Black people, against the struggle of Black people, the work, the institutions that we've created, more than a 50-some-odd economic institution, independent economic institutions. That's part of the reason that they attacked us.
And, you know, one of, I think, the most offensive claims in the case against you is that you were kind of a pawn of the Russians. They suggest that your ideology isn't an ideology that you have. For instance, your opposition to the proxy war in Ukraine, it's not because you have a very strong record of criticizing NATO, criticizing interventionism, criticizing Western interventionism. It's because you're some Russian controlled dupe. Right. So can you speak to that? I mean, how long have you had these ideas that you have that they are accusing you of doing at the behest of, sharing at the behest of Russia?
I think it's important that you mention Sami Al-Aryan and his daughter, because we organized the largest anti-war mobilization after the 9/11 that happened in the Southeast. We had mobilization at MacDill Air Force Base, where much of this effort was headquartered. Our history has been one of opposition to these horrible wars. We were against Vietnam. We were against the attacks that were made on Cuba. I was in Nicaragua shortly after independence that was there. So we have been opposed to this, and they know it. And the fact is, they got all the documentation that shows it. And one of our lawyers asked the lead FBI agent, is being opposed to the war un-American? Said no. Was that, you know, like some offense? No. Is working to expose genocide against Black people, which they said the Russians inspired as well? No. And so this is the kind of thing that happened. So that's why it was impossible for them to convict us for being under the direction and control of Russia, a foreign government. But what they did was they convicted us of being conspiring to do something that never happened, to conspiring to be under the direction and control of the Russian government. And which is extraordinary because that's a thought crime. It's mean that they didn't have to do anything. I had to have thought that based on their interpretation of whatever it was that I said or et cetera. So that was, it's a bogus charge. We've always been opposed to those wars. We've always demonstrated against those wars. We've always supported the Palestinian struggle. We've always supported the people in Iran. We organized one of the first mobilizations in Gainesville, Florida, when the Iranian Revolution first kicked off. And the Iranian students took that nest of spies called an embassy, American embassy in Tehran. And in this country, people were beating up people, attacking people who they thought were Iranians, or they couldn't know that Iranians were not Arabs. So if they were Arabs, they were attacked. And in this prestigious University of Florida campus in Gainesville, Florida, they were having nighttime rallies saying, "Niggers, go home." They were doing stuff like send the Klan to Iran. This is a prestigious school there. And so we organized mobilization protests against that. We organized the Black community. We marched against that. And the first march was attacked. I mean, by mobs of white people, they attacked that. So the second one, we succeeded in making that making it happen, and the attackers, the hundreds of white people chanting America, waving American flags, attacked us. And so the point that I would make is that we've always been opposed to those wars, because the United States is incapable, has never participated in a just war, can't participate in a just war, and we recognize that. And we've said it all along, and that's part of the problem that the U.S. government has with us. And of course, the bigger problem is that we are an organization that's based on self-determination, anti-colonialism, African people being self-governing people, being in charge of our own affairs. And this is something that hasn't happened since the 1960s. And when we had people like the guy who was Attorney General Mitchell, John Mitchell at that time, declare that by the end of 1969, the Black Panther Party would be destroyed. This is a time when J. Edgar Hoover headed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, said that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of this country since the Civil War. This was 1969 when they attacked, they killed Fred Hampton in his home. They attacked the Black Panther Party the next week in Los Angeles, and firefight went on there. This is the stuff that we've dealt with and had to deal with as Black people struggling against our oppression and exploitation here in this country. So no, we didn't just come up in opposition to these things. We didn't just start doing this stuff. They said that the Russians are responsible for the stance that we take on reparations. But the fact is that I organized the first movement at International Tribunal on reparations for Black people that happened in this country. The first quantification of values stolen from African people on labor alone, I organized that. And it was based on international law. It was based.
And when was that?
That was in 1983, 82.
Well, maybe Putin did time travel to convince you to do that.
That's what somebody said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really infantilizing. And, you know, there's obviously a long history of the FBI and the US government accusing Black radicals of being pawns. And, you know, you even have people like Kamala Harris making that point. She said that the knee protest that Colin Kaepernick did was probably Russian bots.
Yeah.
What is her name? Karen Rice. Karen Rice, yeah. Who said it was outside agitators at the George Condoleezza Floyd.
Rice. Yes.
No, not Susan Rice. Susan Rice.
Susan Rice, yes.
But they
yes.
both said it, I think. Honestly, yes. They both said it. Yeah. Yeah. And I just wanted to ask you, what your thoughts are, given that you were being treated this way under Biden, what are your thoughts on the difference between Trump and Biden on whether or not you think either of them are fascists?
Well, colonialism is colonialism is colonialism. And that the fascist issue that I hear raised consistently now is something that becomes convenient when it looks like the colonial contradiction seeping into the general population. But nobody was talking about fascism when they killed George Floyd, or when they were murdering black people throughout this country. Nobody says it's fascism because you have this huge African prison population, something like one out of every three African men between the ages of 18 and 35 going to prison. It's not fascism. It's when it appears to threaten the rights of white people that fascism gets raised. And some black people raise that too, but they raise it because the colonial question is the critical question. And so you can have a right-wing colonizer and a left-wing colonizer, but we're still colonizing. If you look at France, this supposedly leader, vanguard of the struggle against fascism during the Second World Imperialist War, at the same time it was fighting Nazis in France, it had colonies in Algeria, all over right. Africa, and Vietnam, right. And et cetera, et cetera. So the question is colonialism. It's a colonial mode of production that is a parasitic relationship that encapsulates the entire world. And that's what we are dealing with. So you know, I'm not going to go that way, because what they're asking me to do is to be pro-democratic party. I'm against fascism because Trump is a fascist, and it's Biden who sent these guys. It's Biden who put 100,000 cops in the streets of this country using Clinton. It's Biden who is the one who puts forth the anti-crime bill. It's Biden who, when he was in the Senate, was opposed to the civil rights bill. It was Biden who was opposed to busing even, because he didn't want his children to go to school in the jungle. So I'm supposed to see Trump as this proto-fascist, and therefore turn my attention and support Biden and Kamala Harris as opposed to being for Trump. I'm for black people. I'm not looking for a new colonizer, whether it's an American colonizer or Russian colonizer, except the whole notion of self-determination argues against this thing they're talking about working and being under the direction and control of Russians or anybody else. In fact, they know we're not under the control and direction of Russians. Their problem is that we won't be under the control and direction of them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and for talking with me. Any final words from you, or anything you want to mention, or do you want to direct people to anything that they can do to support what you're doing? And of course, anyone who can make it, I really suggest that they go to your event on December 16th. I hope that
people can be there. It's the state's event, where again, we're going to be sentenced. The objective of the state is to give me 5 years, and Penny 5 years, and Jesse 5 years in prison, and a $250,000 fine.
And I'm sorry, do you mind if I ask you how old you are?
In October, I was 83 years old. So. It's a lifetime sentence. Yeah, it's a lifetime sentence. That's what they intend to do, to give me. But I think it's really important that the question of free speech is obviously an issue here, and that everybody should be able to fight for that. But I think it's really important that the people, that we let the state know that we know that this is an attack also on black self-determination, on the black community, on black people. You know, we've created institutions, economic development programs, projects that no government in this country has ever done. Not here where we are in St. Louis, not in St. Petersburg, Florida, not the federal government. And they would attack us for destroying food deserts by bringing food and the ability of people to have economic capacity there. So I hope that people will go to Hands Off Uhuru, that's uhuru.org, and come to St. Petersburg, Florida on December 15th, if you can. But certainly come to Tampa, Florida on December 16th, where the sentence is going to happen at the federal courthouse there. And I thank you very much, Katie, for sharing this and your audience with me and us at this time.
Of course, thank you, and best of luck. And I'll keep, we'll update our viewers and also let them know what they can do to support you.
All right.
Well, that was great. So honored to talk to Chairman Eshetela, and we're definitely going to link to his to their website so people can support what is happening, what they're doing, their fight. And of course, I mean, we don't even need to call out the hypocrisy of Joe Biden for pardoning his son for crimes that he helped make illegal, for crimes that he punished in a more draconian way through his crime bill. We are so excited to bring on our next guest. He is a Lebanese-American political science professor, and he is at the University of California, Stanislaus, and he is from Lebanon. And he's also the author of The Historical Dictionary of Lebanon, Bin Laden and the Battle for Saudi Arabia, among other books. And his articles on Middle Eastern politics and culture have appeared in publications throughout the world. So welcome, Assad.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining.
I just want to correct the name of the university. Yeah. It's California State University, Stanislaus. That's all.
What did I say?
University of California, Stanislaus.
Oh, sorry, State University thing. Thank you. I got really paranoid. I was like, did I just name a different state? Okay, but I got it wrong, but not quite as wrong as I could have. So I wanted to ask you if you could situate your political analysis. Obviously, we all know the limits of identity politics, but I think your story is so interesting, and you're someone who has experienced Israel's policies firsthand. Can you talk about what it was like growing up in Lebanon with the, what would you even call it? The extremely violent campaigns and perhaps genocidal campaigns. I don't know if you consider Israel's treatment of Lebanon genocidal. Certainly it is towards Palestinians. How was your life shaped by Israel?
Katie, without exaggeration, my entire life history is basically memories of various Israeli invasions, attacks, raids, as well as massacres. I mean, the entire history. I mean, I mark certain events in my personal life by references to 1978 invasion, 92 invasion, 96 attacks, like before or after. And I am not unique among Lebanese in that sense. I was born in 1960, and already there was no PLO, there was no Hezbollah, there was no Hamas. And Israel was already committing various crimes throughout our region against Arabs. It became very clear to me from an early age that Arab lives do not matter whatsoever to Israel as well as to Westerners, that our lives are dispensable. I mean, one attack against one Israeli to this very day receives more attention than the slaughter of 1,000 or 2,000 Arabs. You can see it every day. Look at the plight of Israelis in Hamas custody versus the plight of close to 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli custody that nobody mentions whatever. And they were in custody long before there was October 7th. As I was growing up, my father is from the city of Tyre. My mother is from Beirut. So we were shuttling between the two cities to visit family and so on. And I remember, even when I was a kid, that on the way to Tyre or on the way back, Israel was bombing South Lebanon. In 1950, Israel attacked a Lebanese civilian airliner. I mean, the first crimes of terrorism in our region were committed by Zionist gang before there was Israel. In the 1930s, tossing grenades in public market, booby-trapped ambulances and buses, bombing hotels, parcel bombs, all those messages were perfected by Israel, which inspired a variety of terror groups around the world. Look at the industrial-level terrorism that's being inflicted along with a genocide on the Palestinian and Lebanese people today. In order to kill Hassan Nasrallah, they flattened, without any warning, six residential buildings together, using 80,000 bombs, with each one having a capacity of 2,000 pounds explosives in them. I mean, they always do overkill, overslaughter, over genocide, because like Nazi Germany, this is a state does not see itself bound by any norms, any laws, any ethical standards in killing Arabs. It realizes that it is so detested in its region, and it is detested not because they are Jewish. I mean, even if Zionism was a movement of Indonesian Muslims, the Arabs would have opposed it just as much. It is a movement that stole a land that was already in existence and kicked out the population. And they kept a very small number of people, which they held to a third degree citizens in the state of Israel. There is today a bill before the Israeli Knesset. I mean, it's laughable how racist that country is. And basically they wanted, so now out of 20% Arabs in the state of Israel, 10% representation are allowed for Arabs in the Knesset. Token representation, They have no power. They don't make decisions. They were never allowed to sit among the adults in the room when they make decisions for the citizens of Israel. And now they want to lower that representation. They say they want to make it less than 10%. But anyway, as far as growing up in Lebanon, it was a story of massacres that never stopped. In 1964, Lebanon installed water pumps on the Wazani River in South Lebanon. So what did Israel do? Israel bombed them and threatened Lebanon if they were to use their own water resources to extract them, to basically water the hungry people and the thirsty people of South Lebanon, they're going to bomb them again. I mean, there are litany of stories, an anthology of crimes that Israel committed that shaped my memory, seared in my memory. My grandfather's house in the city of Tyre is probably, without exaggeration, one of the oldest houses in the city. It still stands today, but it's condemned for a series of bombing by Israel. And it never housed any Palestinian group, any Lebanese group, just because Israel bombs civilians. I mean, of course, and this finds justification in Israeli media. Thomas Friedman just yesterday was praising Israel for bombing what he calls Hezbollah neighborhoods. He didn't say strongholds, Hezbollah neighborhoods. Imagine if Arabs were to incinerate entire neighborhood in Israel and they say, we just bombed or incinerated Likud neighborhoods, for example. Okay. I mean, that would result in a hue and cry in the West. In 1968, Israel decided to destroy the Lebanese civilian airline. Benjamin Netanyahu himself participated in that act of terror against civilian targets. In 1968, there was no Hezbollah, there was no Hamas. In 1974, Israel decided to literally incinerate out of existence, burn it to smithereen, the refugee camp of Nabatiyeh. Many people who go to Lebanon in recent years, I always ask them, do you know there was a refugee camp in South Lebanon called Nabatiyeh refugee camp? It doesn't exist. Because in series of bombing raid in 1974, Israel destroyed it out of existence. I mean, there is no refugee camp that was spared from Israeli bombs that was indiscriminately going against civilians. When I was in 1982 in the residential apartment where we grew up, suddenly there were so many severe bombings we heard, and there was a residential building next to ours. There were no PLO, there was no military presence, whatever. It was flattened to the ground by concussion bombs, crushing everybody during the day who was there, mostly women and children. Men were at work on that day. So that's the history of Israel that I know. So in a way, my childhood was a history lesson in the Nazi-level crimes of the state of Israel. An entity that reminds Arabs with every generation how criminal, how racist, how genocidal it is. We learn about its racism. We learn about its disregard for life, for human life. In a book published by an Israeli writer, Ronen Bergman, who writes for the New York Times called Rise and Kill, he revealed that there was, during the war, we heard so many car bombs that would explode in the south and in West Beirut and in Sidon and in Tyre. And there used to be an anonymous organization that would claim responsibility. It called itself the Front for the Liberation of Lebanon from Aliens or Strangers or Foreigners. And it was assumed in the press, peddled by Israeli propaganda, that this is a purely Lebanese organization. Now we know it was Israeli military intelligence behind it, and they used to send booby-tracked cars, booby-tracked trucks, and booby-tracked donkeys into Lebanon, detonate them among civilians. One of my closest friends almost died by one of those car bombs that Israel detonated in a neighborhood in 1979 in West Beirut. So if you ask me, really, when I really got to learn in the history book and the scholarship about Zionism, I mostly did that in graduate school, back in Beirut, as well as in the United States. I read all the books that were written, but I already was personally educated about the true nature of Zionism and its racism.
Right. I mean, just related to something you said, there were booby-trapped toys, right? Weren't there booby-trapped toys that they distributed?
These were mines that they would throw into Lebanon as toys. You're absolutely right. They littered South Lebanon after 2006 when they were humiliated and defeated with hundreds of thousands of mines that continue to kill people in South Lebanon. This time around, I am sure they will not withdraw without leaving their fingertips, which are prints, which are mines. They always do that.
I mean, that really is so sadistic. And something else that I read today, I found out about today, this is old news, but I happened to read it today. I think I was reading the Democracy Now. Oh, here we go. Bombs and Toys, a brief history of Israeli booby traps in Lebanon. The pager attack is not the first time Israel has been accused of planting bombs in civilian objects. I mean, the pagers was disgusting in itself, but obviously there's another level to it when you're putting them in toys. I mean, you're inherently targeting children. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. Let's see, Brad is highlighting certain things. It can be a toy or have the shape of an ordinary stone. They also mentioned the example of a child who was left with severe burns after finding a booby-trapped flashlight, and another girl who was killed after exclaiming, "I found a doll," before being blown up. I mean, it's so sadistic. And, you know, we also know that right now, children in Gaza have the highest rates of amputations per capita among the whole world. And thanks to Israel's blockade, many of these children are, it's like, I can barely say it. They're being forced to undergo amputations without anesthesia. And right. I don't know how anyone can hear about that, read about that, and think that Israel is doing anything remotely just. I mean, I feel like even if I were a really gung-ho Zionist, I would say, okay, this has to stop. This has to stop, because you can't actually justify not letting in anesthesia.
Well, I mean, two things I want to say about that. One, no, if you're a Zionist, you would be able to justify, like Joe Biden, as a proud Zionist has done, you would justify all that slaughter, because Zionism is basically the belief that Jewish immigrants from anywhere in the world have a superior right over the rights of the existing native population. And their right qualify them alone to build a state that is exclusively with Jewish superiority as political rights, not reserved to the native population. I mean, if you believe in that, you believe that we have the right to kill them and expel them in order to build the Jewish home, as it was called by the Balfour Declaration. The second thing I want to say about that, all the list of crimes that Israel has committed was largely unknown to the world, especially to the Western world. If there is any benefit to the year and 2 months that happened since October 7, and there is no benefit whatsoever, it would be that the Western world learned for the first time, young people learned for the first time, the true nature of Israel, because the mainstream press for decades covered up all these crimes. I mean, imagine Zionist organization, ADL and others, were able to talk to the editor of New York Times, Washington Post, and they were, yes, it is a conspiracy, and I believe in conspiracy theories totally. And they were able to cover up through the German publisher, the Zionist German publisher, French and so on. And the world did not see the true nature. Now the world saw live the industrial level of mass killing and torture by the state of Israel. This is why I see for the first time in my life, I came to this country in 1983. I see young Americans angry. There are college students I don't even know who write to me, want to read more about the conflict because of what they see about social media. Social media is the enemy of Zionism because social media cannot be controlled as tightly as the editorial pages of the New York Times or the photography in mainstream American newspapers. And of course, don't get me wrong, Mark Zuckerberg and others, they collaborate with the state of Israel to censor and to repress and do that. But still, what comes through is enough to educate the world and to enlighten them about what Arabs have been complaining about since 1930s.
Yeah, and I mean, I actually think that this is probably one of the things that is chipping away at people's Zionism as we speak. I think that people are, not everyone's being reached, obviously, but I think that there are people who were raised Zionists who are looking at what's happening. And as you said, it's this. I don't even want to say silver lining, but if there's one good that can come from this, is that capturing this brutality while it's live streamed, I think is really waking people up.
Totally. Even among the American Jewish population, Katie.
Right.
Look, the government of Israel 2 weeks ago commissioned a poll among Jewish Americans, and they discovered that there is actually, out of detestation for Israel, enough sympathy for Hamas among young American Jews. And a third of American young American Jews believe what Israel is doing is a genocide. Of course there is rising awareness, especially among young people. I mean, for me to drive through Pebble Beach and Monterey and see young American and retired American executive, wealthy white Americans chanting Palestine free, free Palestine from the river to the sea. I mean, that would be unfathomable. I mean, unheard of 20, 30 years ago.
Right. So what is happening right now in Lebanon? Because I have a great tweet that the wonderful media critic, Asal Raad, tweeted out, and you also tweeted it out. And she writes, good news, we brokered a ceasefire in Lebanon. So the U.S. flag. So America says, good news, we brokered a ceasefire in Lebanon. And then the Israelis say, we can still attack if we want. Then the U.N. says, Israel breached the ceasefire 100 times. Then Hezbollah says, we're responding to Israel's violations. Then Israel says, Hezbollah breached the ceasefire, we're attacking. And then America says, Israel has the right to defend itself. So what is the status of this ceasefire?
I mean, well, first of all, I call on, I'm glad you mentioned Asal and her great work, and I call on listeners and viewers to follow her on Twitter for the great job that she's been doing since October 7 and even before that.
She's been on a few times.
Yeah. What is happening is the following. There was a ceasefire reached. It was a terrible ceasefire, if you ask me. But the level of destruction, the level of killing of civilians was so high that Hezbollah wanted a respite from all the carnage and the nonstop murder of civilians. I mean, basically, unlike Israel, they thought about the Lebanese civilians, and Israel does not think neither about its own civilians nor about the civilians, of course, of the enemies, for which they hold in great contempt. So the ceasefire dictates that both sides will cease fire, literally, as the name says, and they will withdraw from Lebanon in 60 days, and they will stop firing, basically. But Israel has not stopped, not taken a break for one day. They keep on killing, they keep on warning. And of course, they were totally shocked and humiliated because the people of South Lebanon, who were displaced more than a million, 1.2 million people, immediately rushed to go to South Lebanon because they don't want to be displaced. They know enough about Zionism to know if you abandon your homes, the Israelis will have settling design on them to basically deprive Israel of that opportunity, because there are Zionist forces in Israel that are already claiming South Lebanon as part of the land of Israel. And there were voices like that in 1982 and before and after. This is definitely there in, you know, in Ben-Gurion diary as well as in Zionist literature. So in order to avoid that, they rushed into South Lebanon. Israel is very unhappy and they want to intimidate them and terrorize them. And that's what they were doing. Hezbollah is holding its gunfire. The Lebanese army was supposed to go there to take care of security, to protect basically Israel from Hezbollah's gunfire. And the Lebanese army is like sitting ducks. They don't fire back. Israel is shooting at them. They have killed already today like 12 civilians, and they killed a shepherd today. I mean, they keep doing these crimes. Of course, America, which is supposedly in charge of implementation, is doing nothing. And of course, we learned from side letters that was exchanged between U.S. and Israel that there is an agreement. Basically, the agreement is that the U.S. interpretation of the ceasefire agreement is such that only Israel will have the right to engage in violence in the name of self-defense, but that Lebanon will have no such right. And the State Department spokesperson Patel yesterday confirmed that. I mean,
we actually have that video. We have that video. Yeah. Should we play it? This is Vedant Patel of the State Department being asked about Lebanon's right to self-defense. Does it have it? Let's take a look at what he says.
Right. Earlier, you mentioned that under the ceasefire, Israel retains a right to defend itself. Yeah. I mean, does that same right transfer to the Lebanese state? I say this because Israel's new defense minister today said that if it fails to deter Hezbollah from attacking it, the Lebanese government will not be immune from attacks in the future.
So I think you're asking me to, again, speak to a hypothetical, which I'm just not going to engage on.
Is there something in the ceasefire that says if attacked, the Lebanese state has the right to defend itself?
So at the crux of this, at the crux of of this long conversation that we've been having as it relates to northern Israel and southern Lebanon has been UN Security Council Resolution 1701. And at the center of that is this notion that Hezbollah will withdraw to north of the Litani River and that likewise Israel will return to south of the Blue Line back to Israel. I think to just pressure test your question a little bit, I don't think that there is a desire from Israel to invade or attack the Lebanese people. What we're talking about is specific acts or incidents of self-defense. Again, I'm not going to...
Still killed 12 Lebanese.
Certainly I'm not trying to minimize the impact on Lebanese civilians, but I'm not... I just don't have an assessment to offer on some of these specific incidents beyond just saying that as it relates to the ceasefire, there is a mechanism in place to address violations. And ultimately, at the crux of this, the Israel, if it is threatened or if its security is violated by Hezbollah, by a terrorist group, they certainly have the right to their self-defense.
But it's a chicken and the egg. Does Lebanon then not retain that same right? Okay. Let's say Israel is the aggressor.
Again, we are going down a slippery slope of hypotheticals. It is a bit of a hypothetical because on one side we are talking about a terrorist group that, as part of its mission statement, has the destruction of Israel stamped at the center of that. And on the other side, you have Israel, a sovereign democratic state.
Lebanon three times.
Part of what we are talking about and part of this ceasefire is for Israel at the crux of 1701 is to withdraw to south of the Blue Line. I think these situations are not totally comparable, but I really appreciate you trying.
Okay. And shout out, by the way, to journalist Will Lowry, who tried to actually, ask a very relevant question that Patel claimed was like some kind of hypothetical gotcha.
Katie, I mean, it's racism. I mean, this is not politics. They are just plain racist. I mean, this is why I always think over the last year, if you just watch the two spokesperson at the State Department and the two at the White House, you cannot, as a progressive, ever vote for the Democratic Party again, just based on that rhetoric. If you ignore American actual support for genocide, all the statements can be collected and without deconstruction, take them as they are. They drip with racism on a daily basis. Basically, they say we measure human life just like the Nazis. These are Nazi-like statements. One people have one right, the others have another right. Just like the Knesset agreed like 2 years ago, which is that self-determination is a right to be enjoyed on the land of Palestine only by the Jews, but not by the Arabs. They're just blatantly racist.
Or like saying that inserting sticks into people's rectums is legitimate, as a member of the Knesset said recently.
People who don't follow as you and I do, I mean, they debate rape publicly and, in this polite discussion and academics and intellectuals engage in such a debate about rape. Is it utilitarian? Is it useful? Yeah. Is it not about the ethics of rape? I mean, they agree that whatever is in the service of Zionism, we'll do it. But is rape good for us or bad for us? Is bad image and so on?
Yeah,
they talk about these things. But, Israel's of the 1950s Hollywood has been dissipated over the years. And it's a very different Israel. It is the real Israel that people see for themselves, especially over the last year and few months. And I think on the long term, it will eventually undermine whatever support there is in the West. And it's already growing in public opinion, sympathy for the Palestinian. Having said that, you cannot count on public opinion in Western countries because these countries are not democratic, certainly not when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, in France, in Britain, the public opinion is much more pro-Palestinian than pro-Israeli, yet the government follow United States undemocratically.
Right.
So the Democratic Party today, for example, there is at least split within the ranks and file of Democrat, but the Democratic leadership wouldn't allow one person who is sympathetic to the Palestinian to become within the leadership of that party. I mean, look at the National Convention of the Democratic Party. They wouldn't even allow Palestinian speakers because they are racist. They don't want people they view as inferior to spoil their party, the party of celebrating Israeli genocide and aggression.
Right. Joy and aside, they kept talking about joy. I think we said on Useful Idiots, it was joy and aside, genocidal joy. Right. And then, of course, you have, it probably is convenient, right, to have someone like Karine Jean-Pierre or Vedant Patel, probably more convenient.
Or John Kirby.
Than having a John Kirby, because John Kirby's white, right? So that makes it a little bit harder to hide the racism. But I want to know, you've made a couple times, you've talked about the Nazi-like tenor or made comparisons between Zionists and Nazis. And that, by the way, is something that I just want to insert this, that I'm making a documentary right now about Holocaust survivors, and Brad is working on it with me. It's about Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. And these people, many of them, you know, not everyone does, but many of them say, of course, there are parallels between what the Nazis did and what the Zionists did. And one of our subjects says that they learn stuff, like the Zionists learn things from Nazis, including, you know, humiliation. So I want to ask you to elaborate on these comparisons.
Right. Let me be personal, Katie, about this one. I don't mind being personal. So I grew up in Lebanon as a Muslim Arab who became, revolutionized at an early age, drawn into Marxism and revolutionary ideologies with the Palestinian movement and so on. I was always against a two-state solution for the liberation of Palestine, establishment of a state in the land of Palestine where everybody lives equally and so on. Maybe because of my radicalism or the way I viewed it, I was always sensitive to the Jewish question very early on. Even though I grew up in Beirut, where most of the Jews were left Lebanon already, they were like five or six, and I would ask about where they are, and I would go and even though I have no power, and I would check on them, see if anybody's bothering them and so on. And I also educated myself about the Holocaust, and I used to sternly warn Arabs against any Nazi analogies. Or against any Holocaust analogy. I was very firm about it. I wrote in Arabic about it. I gave speeches, interviews about it. I never, never accepted it. Because I read enough about the Holocaust, and I believe there should be a special solemnity and respect for the victim of the Holocaust, for the uniqueness of the horrors inflicted on the Jewish people at the time. And I have not deviated from that respect. But now, since October 7, I argue that out of my deep respect for the victims of the Holocaust and the crimes inflicted by Nazi Germany, if we see any resemblance in current times, we need to speak out against it. And it is in that spirit that I now say it is not politically or PR convenient that we invoke the Nazi or Holocaust analogy in regard to the State of Israel, but it is morally the right thing to do because there are clear analogies. I mean, when you have officials of Israel giving material for the petition by South Africa, in which they say we want to deprive them of food, of water, of electricity, I mean, they make their intention of genocide very clear. In that sense, we will say this is very much like Nazi Germany. If anything, I mean, Nazi Germany, they used to be less explicit. They would speak behind closed door. The Nazis of Israel today, they were very open about it. They are totally explicit. Why do they do that? Because they know since the Zionist movement, the racism of the Zionist movement always appealed to the West. From the first time of Theodor Herzl, right, when he spoke about creating of a Jewish state in which there will be civilization as opposed to barbarism of the Arabs, when he invoked a proverb in French, qui veut la fin veut le moyen, to justify the slaughter of civilians. When they started like that, we realized that this is a movement that made as its intention the denigration, the subjugation, and the slaughter of a large number of the native population to make it feasible for Arabs, for the Israelis to establish their own state. But they early on knew that the racism of the movement, and it called itself colonial early on, because right, it was a colonial movement that was born in Europe in the late 19th century. And they said the aim of the Zionist movement in the first declaration of 1897 in Basel, Switzerland, that the aim is to colonize the land of Palestine. Right. It wasn't a dirty word. And they spoke to the racism of the West, and the West has always identified with Israel because of their very contempt for the Arab and the Muslim population. And they didn't know and they didn't care about the Christian native population. And of course, they didn't do that because of the love of the Jewish population. They didn't.
Right.
But in the balance, I mean, just like Nazi Germany, the West has a hierarchy of races and ethnicities that they hate. So they hate Arabs and Muslims more than they hate Jewish people. And there is still anti-Semitism among Westerners. Some of the top Western officials who supported Israel were anti-Semite, from Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, Lord Balfour. I mean, the list is too long to list right now.
Right. And what are some of the things that make you think of the Nazis? Like any particular policies or discourse?
The industrial level of murder. Israel is really trying to kill the largest number of people possible. Two, the use of technology to achieve a large number of murder of people. I mean, when you throw 80 bombs in one night, destroy 6 residential buildings, there is no explanation of that except to kill a large number of people. And every few days, they would destroy another residential building. And they did that nonstop over the last year and 2 months since October 8th when they started their war. And they were planning on doing that. I mean, look what they're doing in Gaza to make life unlivable, to want to push out of the land a large number of people and kill as many of them, to use terror on a mass level. This is all intentional genocide.
Yeah.
I mean, to starve and to declare your intention that you want to starve them and to have total disregard for their lives. And most importantly, to use the rhetoric of denigration of the population, comparing them to animals. That's what the Nazis did. Right. I mean, read the rhetoric of the magazine that Goebbels edited. It is just like what I read in Israeli newspapers by Israeli officials. I don't care if they are labor, if they are left, center. Right. There is no differences. If anything that was revealing for many in the world who care about human life is that there are no left, center, or right in Israel. They're all the same when it comes to disregard of Palestinian life. I haven't heard of one Israeli fighter pilot who basically refused orders to kill civilians. They are killing civilians on a daily basis and brag about it. They are bragging about what they do. It is a society that is rotten to the core because it is racist to the core. It is Nazi-like to the core. They have no respect for their lives. And I think they are doing a large number of killing for, as a message. They wanted to kill so many tens of thousands of Palestinians after October 7th to scare the population, to deter people in the future from doing anything in terms of armed resistance against Israeli occupation.
Right. And I think that some people will say, oh, no, but they don't have the gas chambers, as if that is the only problematic part of the Holocaust. I mean, was it not bad enough that they ghettoized people, that they rounded them up, that they shot people, that they starved people? You know, it is so disturbing and disgusting to see people not make the connections between, you know, the Holocaust and what's happening today. It always makes me think, like, so you probably would have been a Nazi if you hadn't been Jewish. Like, why not? Like, your ethics and morals don't bring you to empathize with the people who are being subjugated and exterminated. So you probably, you know, had you had the luck of being an Aryan, maybe you would have been a Nazi too, because you don't seem to see anything wrong with this.
And it is not a coincidence that the neo-Nazis of Western Europe and the neo-fascists and the far-right groups all identify with Israel, because they spring from the same ideology. I mean, Nazi ideology, if people paid attention to it early on, it has all of the blueprint for a future of Nazi-like crimes against the Arab population. They have been murdering school children all throughout the life when I was a kid, killing children and not worrying about it. This is their history.
Yeah, and playing the sounds of babies crying to bring people out so that they can shoot them. I mean, this is like totally perverse.
Perverted. And also the mix. And by the way, there's another analogy with Nazi Germany. The mixture of sexualizing the racist murder of the civilians. I mean, this is very much Nazi-like. Look how much there is sexual imagery and sexual torture and Israeli soldiers in sexual positions as they murder the native population. That all come from that memory of Nazi Germany.
Right. And of course, if you say this, you know, the most despicable thing is if you say this, you're the anti-Semite. It's more problematic for these people to make that comparison than it is for the people to be doing the things that are actually comparable.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, even though I'm an Arab, I never am intimidated by these false, bogus, politicized charges of anti-Semitism. Sure. There are real anti-Semites in this world, of course. And I think I've always called for the rejection from our movement. And I always speak out against them. But on the other hand, we know that Israel and Zionism use the charge of anti-Semitism to intimidate criticism of Israel. And that, to me, is a great service of anti-Semitism because it empties the term from its true meaning. I mean, and when Israel uses that charge, I say to myself, I don't take lessons about the horrors of anti-Semitism from Zionists necessarily,
right,
because they are more willing to join alliances with anti-Semites. I would never join alliance with anti-Semites. I reject anti-Semites when they creep into our movement. But the Zionists have no qualms about it.
Right.
I mean, look at Elon Musk. Elon Musk made it very clear he is an anti-Semite. There was no question about it. He travels to Israel, and now he is endorsed and praised. ADL does not worry about this powerful man who is anti-Semitic, revealing himself publicly because he supports Israel. Any anti-Semites can be forgiven if they support Israel. Anwar Sadat, the one who is fondly remembered by Zionists, was an unabashed Nazi anti-Semite. It didn't bother them. Mahmoud Abbas, the United States want to put that lousy man, corrupt, unelected man, in charge of Gaza as a collaborationist surrogate leader on behalf of Israeli occupation. That man wrote a PhD dissertation, a lousy one, in Moscow, in which he denied the Holocaust. These are anti-Semites. Right. Arab anti-Semites always find refuge in the Zionist movement.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you said that it's dangerous, and I think there is already blowback, and I don't want to, like, we're going to talk more about Palestine and Syria. I don't want to, like, privilege or act like the priority here are Jewish feelings or safety, but I have to say, you know, there's that guy, like, Jake Shields, I think is his name. I think he's an MMA guy. And he interviewed David Duke, and not in a confrontational way. And so I commented on this on Twitter. I was like, oh, silly me, thinking that Jake Shields is an anti-Semite. And people are like, well, maybe you should listen to what David Duke has to say. He's actually not an anti-Semite. He's just an anti-Zionist. And so now you have people infiltrating the pro-Palestine movement. Some, I think, people, the reason I even comment on this is because I think there are people out there who are so used to Israel hiding behind the anti-Semitism claim that it has become, like you said, empty of meaning, which means that it's harder to point out when there really is anti-Semitism. And now I have to explain to people that David Duke is an anti-Semite.
Exactly. And David Duke appeared on Al Jazeera more than 15 years ago. And I spoke out against it because somebody like that should never be allowed into our camp. And we should reject people like that. And I have seen during this war, Katie, some accounts with names like Tom and Adam and so on that have no real name behind them, in which they vomit anti-Semitic vile rhetoric. And those should never be made as allies, and we should never retweet them or engage with them. I view us in the pro-Palestine camp as protector of real justice. And as a result, we are the one who fight real anti-Semitism, unlike the Zionists who play games with that fight.
And create it. I mean, there's no way you're not going to create more anti-Semitism when you're literally live streaming a genocide and saying that you're doing it in the name of Jews.
Right. I mean, Israel has been a contributor to the rise of anti-Semitism, no doubt about it. And some of the early Zionists even warned about that, and they had that concern. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about your interviews with Nasrallah, and what you can share with us about him as a person, and how these interviews were even arranged.
Well, I mean, I write in Arabic regularly in a radical leftist newspaper. But before that, I wrote in, you know, here and there. And I was present on social media and I had a blog that some people knew about.
The Angry Arab.
And also, I appear on Arab media since the late 1990s. And I also was giving a lot of lectures in Arabic in Lebanon at the time, in which I speak about Palestine. So I asked for a meeting to interview him late 90s or 2000, something like that. And I interviewed him, and they never, unlike people who tell you stories, because I read a story by somebody who works for Al Jazeera, and he said how he was put in the trunk of a car and blind. I was never blindfolded. I was never put in a car with fumed windows. I was never searched. I even one time said, like, you need to search me. And they were like, no, we're fine. So even though I go there, and he knew that I'm a secular leftist with a Marxist-Leninist pedigree and so on, and it was never an issue. And
by the way, I'm sorry. I forgot to, for those who don't know, Nasrallah, Hassan Nasrallah, of course, was the who was just killed by Israel and was the head of Hezbollah.
Correct. And with me, at least, I can speak about my experience. I would be very tough in my questioning. I asked about Iraq and how they made alliances with the pro-occupation Shiites in Iraq and so on. And he would answer me very frankly. And he also listened. Unlike most people I have known or talked to, presidents, prime ministers, he is a listener. He listens to people when they speak. He does not carry his weight in conversations. He accepts criticism. One time, after the war in Iraq 2003, I sat down without any social courtesies that are common. I bombarded him with a series of questions about the party's position in Iraq.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.